Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins.
Hey, everybody. Another episode of the Hunting Collective. I'm pretty excited about this one. It's another version of Candy and Vegetables. We get real ridiculous and real damn silly in the opening segment, and then we have a real deep dive discussion to follow. So hopefully you're getting to enjoy that pattern. We're going to start out with the THC top fives, and that's because we're bored. It's summertime. We got nothing else to do, so we just picked four topics and picked the top five things. Sitting in to help me with that was Sam Soholt, the public land bus guy, Spencer Newharth, hunting editor here at Meat Eater, Maggie Smith from our production team, and Phil the engineer, as always. And by the way, thanks for all the emails on the Keep Phil movement. That's still going on. And after the top fives, which was pretty fun, we get into a discussion on human evolution with William von Hippel. And William is a professor of psychology at the University of Queensland down there in Australia. He's got a lot of interesting things to say. A book called The Social Leap that helps to describe who we are, where we come from, and even what makes us happy. So stick around for all that. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about a little bit of First Light Nemo collection. This is something that just came out from the First Light team, and they partnered up with Nemo, who makes lots of cool outdoor gear, to put together a collection that includes tents, sleeping bags, field blankets, chairs, all kinds of stuff. Pretty much anything you can think of in regards to going outside, sleeping comfortably or sitting comfortably. I'm looking at that Nemo Endurance tent that they have with the sick First Light patterns. You can go to firstlight.com and look at that collection. It's on their homepage right now, as a matter of fact. It's that First Light times Nemo collection at firstlight.com. So check it out there. And without further ado, episode number 72.
I guess I grew up on an older road. A pedal to the metal, always did what I told. Until I found out that my brand new clothes are came secondhand from the rich kids next door. And I grew up fast, I guess I grew up mean. There's a thousand things inside my head I wish I ain't seen. And now I just wander through a real bad dream, or feeling like I'm coming apart at the seams. But thank you, Jack Daniels. Oh, number seven.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to episode 72 of The Hunting Collective. I am once again Ben O'Brien. And today we're going to have a bit of a roundtable discussion, probably one of the more important roundtable discussions we've ever had. And we've just in the last two podcasts discussed for hours and hours veganism, animal rights, speciesism. We've discussed public and private lands. And now we're going to discuss things way more important than that. And this is our summertime. It's the end of July, right, Maggie?
Mm-hmm.
The end of July. We've had a great July. Did you have a good July, Maggie?
Oh, it's been fantastic.
What all did you do?
I've done a lot of stuff. I've gotten to fly fishing. I'm learning how to fly fish.
Wow.
Been paddleboarding a ton, running up Baldy, the crew.
Running up Baldy with the crew? Mm-hmm. Check out that. What's your Instagram handle?
At the Lone Loon.
At the Lone Loon. That's good content. So look up At the Lone Loon. What have you been doing in July there, Spencer?
Enjoying the Montana weather.
Yes.
Because it kicks ass.
It does kick ass.
Way nice. I was just down in Salt Lake this weekend, and it was like 100 degrees all weekend, and I forgot that some parts of the country are like that. And I was looking at my phone. I saw
totally.
Like Bozeman. It was like 78, and I'm like,
oh, it's perfect here.
Everybody just... And if you follow At the Lone Loon, which you should do, you'll see a lot of real good, like, Montana living content over there.
Well, thanks.
It's a good time. So I'd like to add at least 1,000 followers to At the Lone Loon. So please, if you're going to do anything for me this podcast, get over there.
Well, thanks.
Sam's got enough, you got enough followers, but Sam Soholt's here.
I am here.
He drove the bus into the Meat Eater parking lot.
Sure did.
He parked it in a handicap zone.
No, that's a lie. I parked it behind a handicap zone.
So God forbid any handicap people want to back out of their spot.
Well, yeah, it's probably not quite legal, but it's hard to find a tow truck that big in such a short time span. So yeah. I'll be all right.
The best thing you're gonna do is like fence it in.
Yeah,
that would be, and then that would compound the problem.
Yeah, I'll just back out.
How was your July, Sam?
My July has been busy. I have been just driving the bus around a lot. So celebrated 4th of July back in South Dakota, and then flew out to Colorado, picked up the bus, drove to Park City, and then did a 4-day camping trip up to Big Sky for the next Total Archery Challenge, and now I'm here.
Wow.
Yeah.
I got to check out this bus.
This is the bus. You never been in the bus?
No.
Maggie? Oh, boy. Phil, have you ever been in the bus?
I don't even know what bus you're referring to.
Unbelievable. Phil is, it's problematic having Phil around. He just never knows what's going on.
Hey, you tell me you like different perspectives here on the Hunting Collective.
That's a lie.
Oh, no, I've been telling myself that to make me feel better. So if that's a lie, I don't even know what I'm doing anymore.
So Phil, what you've been doing in July? You've become a recurring guest on the Hunting Collective. That's changed your life. There's a movement afoot to keep Phil on the podcast.
I can't leave the house anymore. It's a problem.
Yeah.
I've been trying to get out where I can, doing some hikes here and there. I've got a one-year-old, so it's a little difficult to...
That'll stop it.
Yeah.
That'll stop it.
Mm-hmm. Trying.
No, you're doing good.
Thanks.
Yeah. I mean, this is you've 5 straight Hunting Collective episodes for you, Phil.
Yep.
Woo. That's a streak.
I'm real proud of you.
Ben, I think we need to mention your terror of a 2-year-old just completely ripping up his knee and elbow.
Yesterday, I was at the Total Archery Challenge yesterday, and my son, James, is a bit, he's getting his feet under him, like I say. His whole body is just, at this point, just basically scar tissue. Like he rides his bike, he gets on his Jeep, he just does things and then falls off the things and then cries for a minute. And then we have a thing, I'm like, say, I'm tough. And then when he's done crying, he's like, I'm tough. And then runs. And a lot of times he'll say, I'm tough, and start running and then like run into a tree or something. That's a problem. But yesterday at the Turtle Archery Challenge, Sam's bus was there, of course. And Sam has, thank God, had some Band-Aids because James got into the bus, beeped the horn very loudly to alert everyone to James's presence. Ran out of the bus, fell down, ripped his knee open, bled over all over me and everybody else. Sam Sam was nice enough to have a Band-Aid to save the day. So thank you, Sam.
First aid kit in there, so we're
Boss's
good.
Boss's first lawsuit, maybe.
Yeah.
He was off of the bus, so I can't file anything.
He was within a 30-foot radius of the bus.
The bus gave him that energy, though.
It's possible.
But then later on, he was in the Yeti booth, and he was like running around a corner and fell and ripped up both his elbows. So I had to go back to the bus a second time and be like, hey, Sam, remember when you gave me that one Band-Aid? I need at least 2 more.
Yep.
You might need to replenish your stock.
I do. I need to go shopping.
Yeah, so. You need to have like a medical kit. So
For the listeners and definitely not me, can we explain what this bus is?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the
Thanks, Phil. We'll get back. Don't take control of my show, Phil. But yes, please.
So the public land bus has been a project over the last 2 years. I took an old school bus, converted it into my rolling hunting camper, basically.
Okay.
And I've been traveling for 2 years and spending time on public lands all over the place and basically showcasing the experiences that people can have on those lands.
Oh, awesome.
So raising awareness about public land issues, helping people get educated about conservation.
There it is, Phil.
Yeah.
Literally a school bus.
This is awesome.
It's a Bluebird school
bus. The whole conversion.
Yeah.
So the initial build was about 2 months.
I got an idea. Hey.
Yeah.
Why don't you give all the content to Maggie?
to post on at the Lone Loon, and people could find it there.
Sure. Yeah, that's fine.
Roundabout. Yeah,
I'll just airdrop everything I just did. Like, over the last 2 weeks, I did a
follow at the Lone Loon for all Sam's bus content going forward. Continue. I'm sorry.
No, that's pretty much it. Been traveling for 2 years. And then my brother and I started an apparel company to go along with it. And then $5 from every single item we sell goes directly back to conservation organizations.
Oh, that's wonderful. Cool.
Great. Yeah. Public land tees.
Yes, right.
You just dropped a big check to somebody, right?
Yeah, just Friday night, we wrote a check to our Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation for $5,000.
Yeah. Wow. That went to really
open up access. Yeah,
it went to help with the Falls Creek project they're doing, which is purchasing an easement basically that opens up 26,000 acres of public land.
Unbelievable.
Wow.
Well done, cool. Sammy. Proud of you.
Seriously.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to get to the interview portion of the show. This episode is Dr. William Von Hippel, and I couldn't remember his name last time, Phil.
Well, to help you remember, it rhymes with Nipple.
That's how I got it. Yeah. I was like, what's his last name? Nipple.
I asked you if I should cut that out, and you said, nope.
No, it's in there. We're keeping it, bro. We're off the rails. But William Von Hippel is coming up. He's a human evolutionary biologist, so it's going to get real serious during that conversation about like the origins of humanity and how we became who we are through hunting and things of that nature and what it means to us today. It's a really deep, very well thought out portion of the podcast. But before we get to that, we're going to do something that's not either one of those things. We're going to do top fives. We're going to do some real important top fives, and we just happen to have five people here.
Perfect.
To do our top fives. And we haven't really researched this. We're just going to rip it off. And these are important top fives, and we're going to put them out on the internet so people can vote on the top fives. That's what we're going to do, okay? So don't say anything real stupid, and we'll lose. All right, the first one. Which is the first one should we do, Phil, of these four?
Let's start out with the songs.
Songs.
Let's get eased in.
Top songs to get you fired up for a day. We'll just say for a day outside, so we keep it, we keep it germane. Sam.
Oh, man, I had one in mind because I listened to it almost every time I start a road trip with the bus. I'm just going to do that one. DMX, X Gonna Give It To You. Starting off strong.
Classic. You want to give us one line from it?
I'm just going to bark. No.
I'm gonna give you a line. X Gonna Give It To You.
Yep. You really got to get down there to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, Phil, maybe all the ones that people name, you try to sing them.
I'm sure there's a copyright thing that will prevent me from doing that.
No, it's less than 10 seconds, dude. I've done that before on the podcast. Maggie was here last time we did the fashion thing.
Oh, yeah.
We didn't get sued for that. Mm-hmm. So good. We're still going. Okay, that's a good one. X Gonna Give It To You from DMX. Spencer.
I'm not really into like hard rock or white powdery substances, but Buck Cherry Lit Up.
Whoa.
Really gets me fired up.
Good choice.
Get real excited.
Great. Phil, you want to try to give us a line from that song?
I've heard Buck Cherry. I don't know what that song is. I can do the DMX one, though. I know that.
Just do two verses from that, then.
isn't Buck Cherry kind of, it's like Southern hard rock, isn't it?
Buck Cherry's like modern, like hard rock.
All right.
Sing us some. You got a good voice there, Spencer. Get low.
No.
Not going to do it.
No. Copyright thing.
Okay, Maggie.
I have like three.
Okay.
I can't.
You can take
three.
Throw them out there.
You can take the last three spots.
Throw them out there.
Well, currently, I like Truth Hurts by Lizzo. And then I like Zombie by the Cranberries.
Mm-hmm.
And then Damn It Feels Good to Be a Gangster.
Nice.
I'm going to go with that one.
Do you like the new rock version of Zombie? Have you heard it?
Yes, I don't.
Oh, okay.
I really like I like the old school.
Yes, I've heard it. No, it's terrible.
Yes, I don't like it. Okay, Phil, what do you got?
I mean, this is probably like the ultimate middle class white boy answer, but I usually go for The Killers, Mr. Brightside.
All right, that's fine. It's a little disappointing. You'll do better on the next list.
Yeah, we'll see about that.
You ever listen to this song that I'm about to play?
Meatloaf.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Just take a moment. Take a quick break from the show to listen to it. This song is actually 12 minutes long.
Oh, my goodness.
So that will get you in trouble with copyright.
Yeah.
As long as we talk over it and the algorithms can't pick it up.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We can do the rest of the 12 minutes of the podcast with this song on. He's not still not even singing.
Oh, no.
No.
Let's skip 10 minutes ahead. Oh, here he comes. Nope.
No. I think it's like a 3-minute intro.
This is the one.
I mean, this is it.
This is the winner.
This would be an ugly playlist we'd have put together right now.
You think Buck Cherry is that
the right next to it? It's very an eclectic. We should do that. We should do like a. We should offer playlists to people. We should put them together. Yeah. And then people can tune in.
Just do a Meat Eater Spotify account.
Yeah. This is one of those songs you don't even have to know the words.
It's just that. It's like the joke about early 90s music. It's just all vowels. Yep, there it is.
All right, that's it. Top five. Okay, vote for your favorite somewhere on the internet. Go, oh, you know what we do? Go to the Lone Loon.
Oh, hashtag MX. Hashtag Meatloaf.
We're going to over there at the Lone Loon. All right, what's next, Phil?
Let's do tree stand snacks because I am curious because I have no
idea. Do I get to start again or do I get to end it?
You're going to end it because I feel like you're my closer on this one, Sam. Spencer, you also have a lot of knowledge. Phil, go ahead and give us a. If you were in it, just imagine you've never been in a tree.
Okay.
Have you ever been in a tree?
Nope. I'm going to.
Have you ever sat in the tree for a whole day?
Never.
Weirdo.
Let's say instead of tree stand snacks, I'm going to say. Top Little League snacks for Phil Taylor when he was 9 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Got to go for a classic. He got a Capri Sun and a Chewy Bar.
Nice.
And maybe some Gushers if it's a special day.
I like it.
How would that work in a tree stand?
I like it.
That'd be great.
I don't think there's a bad answer for this.
There's no bad answer for this.
Okay, cool.
Maggie?
Since I've never been in a tree stand either.
But you've sat in a tree for a whole day, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
Gosh.
That's only something that hunters do, apparently. Normal people don't just sit in trees.
I trail run, though, so I'll give you my trail run secret snack.
Hit me up.
I like to eat pickles and drink pickle juice when I'm on my race or doing a long trail.
During the race, you just pull out a pickle?
Well, I usually have people hand them to me.
Oh, okay.
It's a really good handoff. You know, here's some pickles.
I wish you'd like, I'm going to get you some sort of fanny pack that's big enough.
Oh, I have a vest and I stuff the pickles in the vest. It's a great look.
Like sliced pickles or do you like full pickle?
Pickle vest.
Pickle juice has a lot of electrolytes.
Yeah,
right?
And a lot of salt.
Mm-hmm.
Pickle vest. I'm real stuck on this pickle vest idea.
Seriously, if you're cramping, pickle juice.
Pickle vest.
All right. It's good
pickle
to know.
Vest. All right. I'm just gonna go real easy. I'm gonna go real popular. Sour Patch Kids.
Yeah.
Sour Patch Kids. Yes. Spencer.
Apples and beef jerky. Like apples are great because no matter what the temperature is, you can eat an apple. Whereas like if you take a banana with you and it gets below 60 degrees, it's a bad banana.
That's a great point.
Yep. Apples are a little bit loud though.
What about a banana vest?
it would work.
You have to be careful. You just can't like push your arms against it very hard.
Oh yeah, any like oblong food could fit in a pickle vest. You could fit beef jerky in there too.
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay, Sam.
So I have two, but I've started doing just a little bit different tree stand snacks the last couple of years. But last year I did hot biscuits and gravy in a Yeti bottle. So that was
wow.
And then if you really want to spice it up, you bake pizza rolls, put those in the Yeti bottle, and then have hot pizza rolls in the tree.
What's the best pizza roll? Is it a Totino?
Yeah.
Sponsor us, Totino.
Yeah.
Come at us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When I was a camp counselor, I used to cook those over the fire for my kids. That was my campfire snack until I got in trouble for it because it wasn't like, you know.
A real camp snack?
Enough.
Bagel bites, man.
How long does a pizza roll stay good for you?
So they do get slightly soggy, but I've had them like 4 hours later, nice and hot.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
The gravy was way better, though. I made like sausage gravy, put it in a 18-ounce bottle with like the chug cap or the chuggler, as Remy calls it. The chuggler. Yeah. And then I just had the biscuits in a Ziploc baggie, and then I just like was either taking a bite and then drinking the gravy or pouring it on top.
Yeah, what were we eating in turkey hunting this year?
Mike and Ike's.
Those were legit.
Oh, yeah.
I'll put that as my second one.
Yeah, Mike and Ike's, Horrible Gold Bears. Like, I mean, I'm kind of a snack guy.
Yeah, I was snacking. Everybody good on that one?
Mm-hmm.
What's next, Phil?
Wild game animal. Let's keep it in the
outdoors. This one is top game animal traits that you would like to have. Is akin to like superhero powers.
Flight.
I mean, I think that ends the discussion right there, right?
No, I mean, come on, Sam. That's too easy.
Sorry.
What game animal can fly? Like, would you like to have quail flight or turkey flight?
I mean, it'd probably be like duck flight, like, would be the best.
That would probably be the best.
Yeah. And at the end of this, we're going to have a superhero built.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
So we can't have two flights.
You want to have a mallard duck's flight?
Mallard duck flight. Okay. Yes.
Spencer.
I'm going to take turkey vision.
Turkey. Ooh.
They can see into the UV light range.
Boy.
Yeah, they can.
They have incredible vision. So now our guy can, or woman can fly
like a duck, see like a turkey.
There we go.
That's unbelievable.
Giannis told me that while we were turkey hunting, and I was just like, mind blown.
Yeah.
I want the stealth of a cougar.
Stealth of a cougar.
All right.
So now we got, you can't see us. We can see you, but we can fly over there and eat you.
Yeah.
Okay, Phil.
What game animal has like the best hearing?
You have to come up with it. So I'm not going to tell you the answer.
Well, I'm going to say something stupid. I'm going to be like, the hearing of a pheasant. And you're going to be like,
the hearing of a... Okay.
You're going to need some kryptonite.
Yeah. So okay. Some, like, the hearing of a pheasant.
It can't hear anything. It's totally... It's totally deaf. I'm going to go with the jaw strength of a croc... Or not a croc, of an alligator. That way.
All right.
I'll bite you down, son. Mm-hmm. That was out of left field. Hopefully that wins.
No, they're all combined.
I'm definitely going to beat Phil.
They're all combined.
They're all combined.
Yeah, that's just one character.
Like, we're flying, but we can't hear anything.
But you can see.
We can sneak up on stuff, but we can't hear what we're seeing.
Yeah. We can see you. We can't hear you. Okay, that's we good? Top game animal. There's any other ones?
Yep. We could have used, like, antelope speed.
Antelope speed would have been a good one.
Sam longevity and top speed.
Yeah.
Yeah, aren't they the fastest animal in North America?
Oh, excuse me, in North America.
Yeah.
They are. Yep.
Yeah. Maybe like a badger's digging ability. That'd be a good one. I'm gonna stick with the alligator. You want to amend yours, Phil? It was pretty bad.
Happy with it.
I admire that you're sticking with it, Phil. Yep,
that's perfect.
Okay, the last one, Phil. What is it?
Top podcast guest that Ben should have on the Hunting Collective.
Living or dead?
Oh, or dead.
Living or dead.
Wow, I need to think.
The dead being impossible, but of course.
I mean, I think one correct answer is Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah, I was going to say that's probably.
That was pretty easy, but yeah, it's fine.
Sorry,
it's fine.
I know. Really softball on that one.
You know, I think you're being hard on Sam for just having the best answers. It's like the power of flight.
Yeah, he's just giving the best answer. Phil, give us a terrible answer. Go.
Pablo Picasso.
What the hell am I going to talk to him about?
You said terrible answer.
You have a real, like, an ear fetish. Then he cut
that
his ear off.
No, that was Van Gogh.
Oh, yeah. Okay, got it. Mm-hmm. Perfect. Moving on. Spencer?
Another obvious one, Lewis and Clark.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That's an obvious one.
Yeah.
That's a real obvious one. Okay. Maggie.
This is hard.
It is.
It's tough. John Muir.
Oh, nice one.
Yep.
I'm going to go Meatloaf, because then he could sing the song. We could spend most of the time just ripping out this classic.
So if you did like a 30-minute podcast, you'd have 18 minutes of it.
Yeah.
Now give all these superpowers to Meatloaf.
Oh, yeah.
Tied it all together.
All right. We're going to put all these polls up, and you got to vote and see who won.
Dun, dun, dun.
Can we put them on the Lone Loon?
Sure.
Okay, we're going to put them on at the Lone Loon. You go at the Lone Loon, and we're going to, when this podcast launches, we're going to have all the polls up there to see who won.
So you're going to bracket it out? Then, well, there's only five of us.
There's only Carter. That's going to be, that's because somebody's going to get a bye in the first round. Then we're going to move on. But now we have to move on to a real serious conversation about human evolution. You guys, is there any list about human evolution, top moments in human evolution? We should have done that.
The Agricultural Revolution. I'm reading a book about this right now, actually. So it's funny that that's your next guest. Sapiens, highly recommend it.
The invention of gunpowder.
Oh, yeah. Industrial Revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
The printing press. This is getting
fire.
Fires. Sam always has the best and most obvious answers. Sorry. He's that guy. Okay, Phil, you're always my closer. What do you want to say before we get into the interview?
Top moment in evolution. I'd say, I don't know, probably like the peak. Peak TV. We got like Sopranos, Mad Men, Breaking Bad, The Wire.
Peak TV.
Perfect. Terrible answer, Phil. All right, now we're gonna we're gonna transport all the way to Australia, where Dr. William Von Hippel is. We're here in the studio, so this was a phone conversation. So please be mindful of that when you're listening to it. But it's a very enjoyable conversation. It's very serious. This wasn't. Hope you enjoy both.
I guess I grew up on an older. There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today, because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate Batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com, use their store locator, and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
Hey, Bill.
Hey, Ben. How you doing?
Good. How you doing, sir? This is a very rare podcast for us for a lot of different reasons, but we rarely do interviews over the phone. But in this case, we attempted a face-to-face. It didn't work out, and you are in Australia at current, so it's about 4 o'clock.
That's right.
Our time here in Bozeman, and you're, what, 8 a.m. down there?
Yep, 8 a.m.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for joining us. I want to learn. Yeah, we got a lot to learn, a lot to cover here in this conversation. But just start us off by talking about your book. I want people to first know about your book, and then we'll get into your history. But The Social Leap. Tell us about The Social Leap.
Sure. So I'm a psychologist, and my goal is to understand how people are. And so I've been spending a lot of my career just looking at, you know, running experiments on people the way we are today. And I eventually came to realize that in order to properly understand people, I had to look into our past. So I spent the last dozen or years working in anthropology and archaeology and all these other disciplines to try to build together a picture of the last 6 million years of our evolution, you know, around the time that we left our chimpanzee cousins. And so the book is really about that. The first few chapters cover the last 6 million years, and then it spends the rest of the book talking about the way we are today, trying to understand things like leadership, innovation, happiness, all that sort of business, by looking at our past and seeing how that shaped our the way we are today.
Yeah, it was really that second half of the book that began to strike me as impactful in my own life and just kind of my understanding of my place in time. And as a hunter, I felt
more connected to the thing that I do after reading it. And it's not, this book is not about hunting. It has some through lines and some parallels to it. It certainly is about more human characteristics and functions of who we are as a species and even as individuals. But talk about how it might be, you know, we've discussed this a little bit in the past, but how it might have through lines to those of us who are we would call ourselves modern hunters.
Yeah, so the if you look at the history of humanity, early on, we weren't really hunters. If anything, we were, you know, very rarely occasional hunters like chimpanzees are. When an opportunity arises, typically if there's monkeys nearby, they'll try to hunt them. And then I think that, you know, our move to the savannah, which I'm happy to talk about, led to us becoming far from hunters, much more hunted. And it was actually our efforts to protect ourselves from being hunted that led us to eventually turn into the hunters that we are today. And I would say that probably for the last, I believe for the last 3 million years and certainly for the last 1.5 million, hunting has been the primary way that we made a living. And so I do think it's something that that's, you know, natural, so to speak, that's very common for humans, that explains a lot about the way we are today and that shaped the way that we became human. So it certainly plays an enormously important role in our evolutionary history.
Yeah. And you mentioned the movement to the savannas, to the grasslands, and how that kind of required a shift from individualism to this new form of like collectivism, as you describe it. Talk about that shift, where we were in time. I think we should properly put ourselves in where we are in time. Yeah, so give us a perspective of where we are as a species and what and how long ago this was, and then kind of what that event meant.
Sure. So about 30 million years ago, the Great African Rift Valley that runs from up north to the Red Sea all the way down to Mozambique started to really get underway. And what that is the continent of Africa is tearing in two pieces. You've got the Somali plate that is moving off to the lower right, and then you've got the rest of Africa moving off to the upper left. And the consequence of that sort of tectonic activity where the continent is tearing apart is all sorts of volcanism, you know, volcanoes forming, but also an upwelling on the east side of Africa. So Ethiopia, Tanzania, Kenya, Somalia, all those areas are getting pressed up into the air. And so, you know, Nairobi now sits at about a mile high. And that upwelling that started about 30 million years ago seemed to basically have finished its job, so to speak, as far as we're concerned, about 6 million years ago, which is when the last of the rainforest on the east side of the Rift Valley really pretty much disappeared. And so what you've got are basically our common ancestors, the chimpanzees, to the best of our knowledge, were pretty chimp-like. And that means that they were kings of the canopy. They ran the rainforest when they're in their group and up in the trees together. But you put them down on the ground and suddenly they're anybody's dinner. You know, they can't lock their knees. They can't, they're not particularly quick on all fours either. And so any large cats and dogs, you know, lions, hyenas, any of those animals would have easily been able to hunt our chimpanzee ancestors on the savannah. And so, you know, how did they respond to this really difficult situation where here they'd been kings of the canopy, they were really top of the food chain, and now suddenly they're thrust way back down to the bottom? And fortunately for us, I mean, this could have easily just been a disaster, but fortunately for us, somewhere along the way, they figured out that they could work together much more effectively than they do in the trees, and that sort of helped solve their problem. And I think that the reason that this came about is bipedalism. So about 3 million years after we left the savannah, we are now walking upright. And I'd be happy to talk about how that came about.
Yeah, please do.
But for now, the point is just that, okay, so for the moment, though, the point is just that we're walking upright, and walking upright completely changes our body. It allows our hips to rotate better and lengthens them out. It allows our shoulders to rotate better. We become more laterally oriented toward the world rather than vertically oriented, which, of course, the chimp's muscles are all designed for going up a tree, and our muscles are designed for dealing with the world laterally. All of those things would have made our bodies much more effective at throwing. And so if you look at, you know, throwing on the beach or among friends, it's typically the sort of small body movement, maybe your shoulders and arms. But if you look at throwing among hunter-gatherers or throwing among proper athletes like baseball players or football players, you realize it's this full body motion that starts with the opposite leg from the arm you're going to throw with, and then you spin through the hips, then you spin through the waist and chest, and then your arm and elbow and shoulder, and finally your wrist comes through, and there's a sort of snap at the end. That whole motion generates enormous elastic energy across your ligaments, your tendons, and your muscles, which is what allows throwing to be so effective. So if you look at chimpanzees, for example, they don't have any of that because, of course, they're still living in the trees. Hmm. And as a consequence, they, even though they're much stronger than we are, they throw very poorly. I don't know if you've ever seen videos of chimps. They'll typically throw with both hands over the top of their head. Sometimes they chuck their crap at each other. But, you know, they don't do it nearly as well as human beings do.
Yeah.
And so the upshot of that is that this change to our body, this move to bipedalism, allowed us to basically create the most important invention in military history, which is the capacity to kill at a distance. And once you get that, suddenly that changes everything, because now you're in a situation where a larger force of weaker individuals can effectively attack a smaller force of stronger individuals, or defend itself from such a force. Hmm. So if you imagine going back several million years under the savannah, you and I are hanging out, and up come some lions or leopards or any of these large cats or dogs. And if there's enough of us, let's say that there's 30 or 40 in our group, we could probably effectively kill it, but we'd be in a huge argument about who attacks it first. Because you know full well that whoever goes first into that lion, you know, it's going to end up in its mouth. Second, third, and fourth probably will as well. It's not until you got enough of us crowded around it that you could probably survive that. See, the consequence of that is, you know, it's just never going to happen, right? You and I, we may look at it, we may know that we could kill it, but we may know that we're going to die in the process, and so no one's ever going to go first. But if we could throw, if we can kill at a distance, now we can successfully attack a lion without exposing ourselves to that enormous risk. And so it's this process that changed everything for our ancestors.
Yeah, and you talk about, you know, 3.5 million years ago, we say these numbers, and we just want to address that, you know, these are millions of years where we think of our lives in these short snippets of time within generations. So as we go through this, and listeners should just be thinking about how long ago this is and how deep this is into the story of our humanity and really the beginning of it. But 3.5 million years ago, you talk about here we are starting to use these defensive strategies in ways never before seen. And those defensive strategies start to marry into throwing rocks and doing other things. And you made a point to me the last time we spoke about, you know, when you're a little kid, you just want to throw it. You pick up a rock, your first thing you think about is to throw it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so if you think about how evolution shapes our psychology, it works in the exact same ways that it shapes our biology. So if you look at our chimpanzee ancestors and you watch them for the first several million years after they leave the rainforest, they're, you know, these sort of lower limbs that they have, which are basically like arms with hands at the end, slowly get shaped into legs that we have today. And that makes perfect sense. You can imagine that one animal that happened to have sort of straighter, stronger legs, that feet were a little flatter, would have an advantage over the other animals. And so that advantage would allow it to have more children, and that advantage would be carried on. Well, attitudes work the exact same way. And so an animal that happened to enjoy throwing from when it was a little kid would grow up throwing more often. It would become a more effective thrower. And so now when it got attacked by leopards or lions, it would do a better job of defending itself. It would survive better, and it would have more offspring. And so these random changes in our psychology or in our biology, evolution ensures that they're carried on if they're good ones, if they facilitate survival and reproduction. And so they don't come about in any kind of planful way, but they do come about just by random changes. And then those random changes that are useful end up just being swept throughout the species. Mm. And so the throwing when you're little is a perfect point. You know, you and I, when we're kids, we'd love to throw rocks. I mean, I still enjoy throwing rocks. And why would you, you know, what's so fun about throwing a rock? If you sit back and think about it, it's not really that special in some ways. But in other ways, it's this extraordinary thing to be able to have an impact on the world out away from you. And of course, what it really meant for our ancestors was survival. So now when they're attacked by a leopard or a lion or even saber-toothed tigers in those days, they could defend themselves by throwing rocks at it.
So, Bill, you're talking a lot about, and it's very important to understand that, you know, we started to be able to affect the world at a distance. I think that's a very profound way to put it. And as we move towards becoming hunters, we develop, instead of these defensive strategies, a more offensive nature to our interaction with animals. And so talk about that very important part, and I think that'll be very interesting to hunters to know kind of how we as a species discovered this activity.
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because that really is how everything changes. You know, here we are in a situation where first, all we're trying to do is protect ourselves. You know, we got these large animals attacking us in the savannah, and we have to find a way to defend ourselves. And that method is to kill at a distance, to throw. But of course, once you discover that you can defend yourself throwing, it's not a massive mental leap to realize that you can also use throwing offensively as well. And so this is really the beginning of effective hunting. It's a move away from the occasional, rather ineffective hunts of chimpanzees toward reliable and effective hunting. And we can see that happening. The very beginnings of that would have been 3.5 million years ago as Australopithecines. And then we can see that developing really nicely as we move toward Homo erectus, where now we've got an animal whose brain has really developed in capacity. We've got this massive increase in brain power. And that suggests that we're bringing in much more calories, that we're finding a much better, much more effective way of feeding ourselves, because, of course, we have to pay the rent on these huge brains. We have to find a way to bring in extra calories in order to afford that added brain power. And so the advantage is that brain power and hunting kind of work hand in hand. On the one hand, as we get smarter, we become more effective hunters. And on the other hand, as we become more effective hunters, we gain the capacity to get even smarter still. And so by the time we get to Homo erectus, we see our ancestors are bringing down really large animals like elephants, bringing down really fast animals like horses. And we're doing so with some very simple tools, which suggests that we're coordinating our activities together really well. And so we got signs of division of labor. We have signs of planning for the future, all sorts of things that our ancestors previous to that couldn't do. So, you know, chimpanzees, they can't ever imagine a world with unfelt needs. They can't, if they're full now, they can't ever imagine being hungry again. If they're hungry, they can't ever imagine being full, which is bizarre to us. You know, we can easily realize, well, right now I'm full, but I'm going to be hungry again tomorrow. I need to plan for that. And we see the first signs of those planning in our Homo erectus ancestors. So, for example, for the first time, we see that the stone tools that they made are being carried great distances from where they were quarried and made originally. And that tells you that once they made these stone tools and used them, they thought, well, I'm going to want to use this again. I better bring it with me on my hunt. Whereas if you look at the prior stone tools, they're quarried, they're made, they're used, and then they're dropped right where they are. It's as if the animal thinks, oh, I'll never need this again. You know, I've used it once. And so all sorts of things change about our mental abilities, and they're tightly interweaved with hunting. Because on the one hand, we need the more calories in order to develop these big brains. And on the other hand, as we get these calories, we find even more effective ways to pursue these animals.
Yeah. Is there a way to unpack the causation there? Because I know, you know, like in the first half of the 20th century, there was a lot of folks that argued that our ancestors, like the urge to hunt and kill, drove us to develop spears and axes. And that then allowed us to evolve bigger and bigger brains in order to handle these increasingly those weapons. And then I've seen other people say it the other way. You know, the fact that our brains were growing based on a lot of the things you've already described helped us be able to hunt. I imagine there's a little bit of both going on, but is there a way to explain that, to kind of unpacks the way that went down?
Yeah, I think that you're absolutely right. The way to think about that is that they both self-perpetuate each other. It creates this virtuous cycle, so to speak. And so on the one hand, if we're going to develop big brains, we need a way to feed them. And so we start to bring in, you know, hunting gives you meat, which is much higher calorie and higher protein levels and more fats. So it's a great source of calories for your brain. And then, of course, once you're effectively hunting, you can then develop a bigger brain to go back and hunt more effectively. And so if you go back way to the beginning, what we were talking about earlier. So why did Australopithecines become bipedal in the first place? Mm-hmm. Well, remember, I just argued that they can't envision a world that where they have needs that they don't currently have. So people often say things like, well, maybe they would want to carry food or weapons in case they needed them. Well, that's an animal who can't think in case. They're not capable of thinking, gee, I might want to eat this. If they want to eat it now, they would. If they don't want to eat it now, they would just leave it. So why would they ever be motivated to stand up? Well, as soon as they set off across the savannah, they would have been scared. You know, here they are, this animal that's king of the canopy, but that's easy dinner out on the ground. And so that feeling of fear, I suspect, made them want to have a weapon with them, want to have a stick or a stone in their hands to defend themselves. So there would have been a motivation to try to carry things in order to defend themselves every time they set across the grass. But that would have been it. They'd have no capacity to plan, none of those kinds of things. So, but that alone would have made a big difference, right? So now you've got some kind of weapon and you're crossing the savannah. And then when you are attacked, you've got a chance to defend yourself. Now, over time, that would have slowly led to bipedalism, as those animals who are more effective at carrying weapons were more successful. And then what you've got is now this animal that's got the capacity to kill at a distance, it starts to figure out that it can use that for hunting, but it still can't plan and do things effectively together. That takes an enormous increase in brain power. And so where does that increase in brain power come from? Well, each time they become a little bit more effective hunting, they can afford to grow a slightly larger brain. And those animals who happen to do so would be the ones who are then the most successful. Hmm. And they're going to be the ones who then also have the greatest capacity to plan for the next hunt. And so these things would have cycled in on each other. Perhaps one of the biggest key things was not only do you have straightforward evolutionary processes, but you also have what we call culture gene coevolution. And so by the time you get to Homo erectus, now almost 2 million years ago, you've got an animal that starts to figure out how to control fire. And once you can control fire, now you actually have an influence on your own evolutionary history and your own evolutionary path, because you can now cook your food, release more nutrients from it, and grow an even larger brain from, you know, the same amount of material that previously wouldn't have supported it.
Yeah, and I think fire is a great, you know, great turning point for this. But also thinking about how when these early humans started to hunt, how they did it, you know, the nuts and bolts of what they did, what they used. And there was, I'm not sure how familiar you are with a butcher site that was discovered in Tanzania, I think it was like 2012 or 2013, where they were a lot of tools and things that were showing that these folks, that the early humans were ambushing and killing antelope, gazelle, wildebeest, and, you know, like other large animals, you know, crouching in trees, throwing spears, those types of things. How do you find that in the development? And I know that's been proposed that that's the earliest that humans were hunting, and that's some 2 million years ago.
Yeah, so it's tricky, because if you look back at those distances, you have no evidence for anything except the stone tools that we used. Mm. And so the earliest effective stone tools were these Acheulean tools. They're about 1.7 million years old, maybe as old as 1.9. And these Acheulean tools are these bifacial, really well-designed hand axes. But there's no evidence that they designed them in any way ever to it, like attach them to a spear or anything like that. But an animal that can have the cleverness to design these really lovely bifacial tools out of stone, you can almost guarantee that it's also designing tools out of wood, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be making wooden spears. Chimpanzees even will bite the ends off sticks and turn them into stabbing tools. At least those who live on the savannah in Senegal do that. And so it's a guarantee that our Homo erectus ancestors had tools that were also made out of wood and tools that were made out of animal hides and animal parts. But the problem is those don't survive the test of time. So we don't have any evidence for their wooden spears. We don't have any evidence for their animal products, because, you know, 2 million years is a long time. It's just all going to rot. And so the end result is that there's a lot of inference that we just have to make about, well, what were they using? And it's a safe bet that they were using wooden spears. It's a safe bet that they were using lots of animal products in order to help themselves hunt. And, of course, it's also a safe bet that they're just using their cleverness in the exact way you described, where they'll say, all right, you wait here, I'll wait there, the animal run between us, you know, those sorts of plans that that a chimpanzee can't do, because it can't plan for the future in that way, but that humans are incredibly capable of doing.
Yeah, and I think that's, as hunters, we often talk about, and when we get in these more modern debates about is hunting as much a human activity as any other, or more so, I think this is where it starts, you know, we start to be able to explore that a little bit more, and most modern hunters, I don't think, are aware of the depth, even as we articulated, the depth of what hunting has done for our humanity. And so have you thought about that as you wrote The Social Leap, and have you done your various works on this? Have you thought about exactly how to articulate what hunting has meant from this point forward, and like what it actually propelled in us, and whether we could have become what we are today without it?
Yeah. So one of my favorite examples to look at the power of hunting is to just look at our guts and our brains. And so if you look at the guts of any of the other great apes and their brains, what you see is they've got a lot of gut, a lot of intestine supporting a very small brain. And then you look at humans and you see a very small amount of gut supporting a very large brain. And then you can march your way back in time. And that shifting point from when we had small gut and large brain over to large gut and small brain is prior to Homo erectus. So once you get to Homo erectus, you can see the skeletal structure shows a very flat rib cage, suggesting a very small gut underneath it. When you go back to Australopithecines, now you've got this rib cage that aims outward, which suggests a very large gut underneath it. And of course, we've already discussed how Australopithecines have a small brain and Homo erectus had this very large one. You know, almost as we have another chimpanzee brain on top, but a big step toward us. And so what enabled that, of course, was eating meat. And so if you look at any animal on the planet, aside from ourselves, who lives off only eating vegetables, because human beings can now do that effectively because of farming. But if you look at any other animal, they can't support the kind of brain power that you can support by eating meat. And so hunting is what allowed us to shift from these sort of large gut, small brain animals to these small gut, large brain animals. And the way hunting allowed us to do that was by shifting to this much more high calorie, high fat source of food. If you look at hunter gatherers anywhere on this planet, there's not a single one who's a vegetarian. Vegetarian is something that we moved toward when we could afford to do so. When we're now so well fed that we could make choices about what it is that we wanted to eat. Prior to that, every single hunter-gatherer loves meat. When there's an effective kill, it's an enormously important day for the whole group because, of course, it gets shared out among everybody. And so it's this really big shift that we've got from a world where we had to hunt and where hunting was kind of the most important thing that happened to a world where now, well, you know, hunting is something you could do or you don't need to do. You don't even ever need to eat meat again if you don't want to. And lots of people, of course, have shifted to vegetarianism as a consequence.
Yeah. And how do you think about that? Just from a very tangible, very pragmatic view of what you know about our history of the species and what you know about what you might posit or think of about where we might be heading. How do you think of that? Are people's the modern luxury of choosing to do those things?
Look, it's a great question because on the one hand, especially if you look at things like factory farming and these horrible ways that they treat animals, you think, how could I be part of that? I don't want to, you know, be torturing animals in order to support my dining habits. On the other hand, personally, I really love meat. I really dislike vegetables. And so I'm in a situation where I feel like, you know, self-interest alone dictates that I'm just not going to be a vegetarian. I'm not going to do that. And I think the good news is that because people are very aware of this and because our world is now so wealthy, that we're actually moving to a world where we can both treat animals well and where you can not have to be a vegetarian. And so, all sorts of free-range farming moves. Of course, hunting is an animal where, assuming that you're eating it and not just mounting it on your wall, hunting is a something where you can also have an animal that lived a perfectly good life and then eventually became somebody's dinner. And so, in my mind, there's more ethical ways of doing that. There's less ethical ways. But the other side of that coin, of course, is that, you know, we're the only species on the planet that even has this notion of ethical and what's right and what's wrong. Other animals just do what works. And so you watch hyenas hunt and they'll tear an animal to shreds without even bothering to kill it first, because that's largely irrelevant to them. They're focused on their dinner. They're not focused on how the zebra feels who they're eating. And so it's really a human luxury and an important one, I think, that we start to think about, well, what's it like being on the other side? And so I think that we went through, you know, almost all of our human history was one of hunting. Suddenly we're in a world where it's now a pastime rather than a necessity. And then the question is, where is it going to go in the future? And I think some people argue, well, it's going to completely disappear. I suspect not, for two reasons. One, you know, as we've discussed, it's in our DNA. But two, it's also the case that human populations are now projected to level off around 2100. And then they're going to probably start going back down. And if that happens, it opens up all sorts of scope for, you know, there being more nature out there in its more original state and something that we can interact with more effectively.
Yeah. What do you think, you know, as we discuss all the time, and I want to eventually get back to the timeline of our evolution, but I like this topic. What do you think about these urges that we have, whether they're genetic or biological or however, or they're really evolutionary in there? We have these certain type of, I think of, when I kill something and I know I'm going to eat it, the rush of endorphins I get from that feeling, it's not the killing of the animal that I think brings me some sort of joy or satisfaction. It's not its death, but it's what its death means to me that brings me this joy and satisfaction. And so I often, as a that luxurious modern hunter, as we discussed, try to go through those two ideas and unpack them. Oh, well, when this thing's dead, I know it's going to bring this additive measure to my life, this vibrance to my life through its meat, through the experience of going and getting it, through telling the story. So at its death, I feel joy. But many people that are against hunting would say that you should not feel joy at the death of another sentient being. So how do you see that just from where you sit and what you know?
Yeah, I would have to say that I agree with you. I think that there's so many generations where, you know, all of our generations up till very recently, we were food stressed all the time. We just didn't know where tomorrow's meal was going to come from. Now, we may not be literally starving because most of the time we weren't. We're just literally a little bit hungry and a little bit concerned because each day we have to go out and find tonight's meal. And so what that means is for literally thousands of generations, when we made a kill, we felt joy for the exact reason that you mentioned. Not necessarily because we had snuffed out this life, but because we had now guaranteed our own and our family's survival and our group's survival for another day. And so I think that's inside all of us, that that's inherent to us, that we can move away from that and we can, like anything else, we can evaluate and decide, well, I don't want to feel that way and I don't like that because I don't like hunting or whatever my story is. But I still think that that's this very natural underlying feeling that we have. And so, you know, people go in a million different directions. There's a million different types of personalities. But underlying all of those personalities is this enormously long evolutionary history where hunting was a joyous occasion when it was a success. And it gave us that positive feeling. And so even today, when you think, well, I could go to the grocery store and achieve the same thing, but there were no grocery stores in our ancestral past. And so it's not like I go to the checkout counter and when I tap my credit card on the machine, I get this rush of endorphins because I know I can feed my family, because that's not how it worked. The way it worked was I made a kill and that's what enabled me to feed my family. And so it's the positive feeling we got from that is something that we just evolved to appreciate. Our ancestors who didn't feel positive when they successfully hunted were a lot less successful hunters. And so they ended up not being our ancestors at all. So through this exact process that we're discussing, your attitudes get shaped. And one of those is an attitude of a feeling of joy when you have that accomplishment.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. And that's one thing that one of the reasons why I became interested in this subject so intensely is just because of some of the feelings that I have that I don't know that I could explain to someone who has not experienced those feelings. You know, this is one of the ways. So, and folks that are new hunters in this modern sense or haven't hunted their whole life and are looking for a way to explain that joy that they feel, then maybe they don't understand that it's not about the animal. It's just about that. And to another point that I think you could probably help us explain, when we look at subsistence hunting cultures and we look at a lot of more traditional hunting cultures, the hunter is exalted in the community. The hunter is many times the leader of the community, because without the hunter, people don't live and they do not survive. So hunters, and we've discussed this on a podcast recently, in many of those societies were figureheads and leaders. And so can you discuss that kind of through time and how that correlates to where we are?
Yeah, it's a super interesting history because, you know, if you go back to all the way back to chimpanzees, they're very hierarchical and they throw their weight around and whoever's strongest is constantly beating up on whoever's next. And so that's just how they live and they tolerate it because they have no choice. And then you move to us and we have these enormous abilities to communicate what's going on. And that allows us to form coalitions and create what are called anti-hierarchical attitudes. So if someone's throwing their weight around in our community, and let's say you are, and you're much stronger than I am, so I can't stop you myself, but I can go to my friends and we can all agree that you're being a total pain. And so one night when Ben goes to sleep, he never wakes up again the next morning because we've all created a plan where we're going to off you in your sleep because we're scared of you when you're awake. And so it sets up a world where even the strongest members of our group couldn't lord it over everybody else because the collective is always more powerful than the individual. And so in that context, hunting is also super important. But what it created is a really interesting circumstance where the best hunters also become the most modest because they know everybody in my group knows I'm the best hunter. As a consequence, everybody knows that I'm going to have this tendency to kind of lord it over them because they really need me. So I need to show them that I'm very modest about my abilities. And there's this fascinating book, Hierarchy in the Forest, by Christopher Boehm. And if you read that book, you see how he talks about when the best hunters come home, and they've made a kill, they're super proud of themselves. You can tell it instantly, but they talk about it in these really modest ways. So it's really almost entertaining. They'll say, so they'll come home and, you know, everybody knows they're a great hunter. They're really keen to learn how the day went. And they'll say, so how'd you go today? And so let's say it's me and I've killed a giraffe. It's a really big day. I'll say, oh, yeah, it was okay. I actually got something that's out, but I left it out there. And then you'll immediately go, I wonder why he left it out there. You're like, well, do you need help going to get it? Is it worth going out to get? And I'll say, well, you know, it's so sickly and weak. I'm going to be embarrassed if we go out there and you decide to leave it there. And that's my way of telling you, yeah, I got something freaking humongous out there. And this is a really big occasion. So it creates this extra modesty in me, which is actually evidence of how important it is. And so you have this world where the best hunters are really appreciated, they're really looked up to, and they have this extra social pressure on them to be doubly modest, to act like it's all a matter of luck, to do all the kinds of things it takes so that people won't worry that they're going to start lording it over them and becoming, you know, the sort of despotic member of their group.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that gets into, you know, how we built kind of tribes, how eventually there was tribal separation, and how eventually there became different ways to do things. And we talk about tribal separation a good bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So the this would have been the norm for many, many thousands of years, while we what we call immediate return hunter gatherers, where we live near the equator and where we are eating today what we killed today. But once we move into a world where we can start to store food, then everything changes again. And now those who are in favor of a hierarchy have new tools at their disposal in order to rise to the top. So, you know, if you look, for example, at the Pacific Northwest of the United States, the Native Americans who lived there quickly realized, oh, there's some really reliable salmon runs. They come in at certain places at certain times, and you can store these salmon. You can dry them out and eat them all winter. And so now we have ways of storing food. We have ways of paying off our allies. And so in situations like that, hierarchy reemerged. And now you start to get traditional leadership again. And then it comes right back to what you were talking about. With those leaders in the group, the way to establish your effectiveness is by hunting and by warfare, by showing that I'm one of the top most dangerous and effective members of my group. And then not only does everybody revere you like they always had, but now you can actually rise up in this sort of stable hierarchical structure and eventually become one of the leaders of the group. And hunting was a key way to do that. And warfare, which is a related activity, was another key way to do that.
Yeah. We've talked about kind of the leadership that hunting allowed us to understand and some of the hierarchical structures. We've talked about a little bit of what the protein did for us, but there's something I've always been interested in, and we haven't talked about this before, but conservation as a modern construct is kind of like when we decided we had to eliminate the prevention or prevent the wasteful use of a resource. And I wonder in your study of our hunting history and human history, when we started to see these things as a resource and when we started to evolve into a being that knew it had to some sort of dominion over how many of these things there were in relation to our consumption of them.
Yeah, that's a great question. And unfortunately, the notions of conservation are really quite modern. There's two reasons for that. And the first is that in the past, we never had weapons that were so effective that we could literally kill at will and have more than enough to eat. And so our ancestors were always in really what I would say is a close competition with the animals that they're trying to capture and kill. So sometimes they couldn't find them or they couldn't catch up to them, and sometimes they had plenty and some maybe even occasionally too much. But it was never a situation where they reliably could over cull the animals, where they could kill more than they really needed. And so as a consequence, conservation really wasn't relevant to their lives until the invention of these modern weapons. And then the second problem, of course, is that whenever we're in competition with each other and we're not members of the same group, I might say, well, I'll try to conserve these animals and I won't overkill them, but I don't know that you're going to follow that rule as well. And it creates what we call the tragedy of the commons, which is that you can see today, for example, in overfishing of the seas. I say to myself, well, I don't want to fish anymore now because there won't be fish next year, but I'm worried you're not going to follow that rule because you're from a different country or a different group inside our own country. And so because I can't trust you, I kind of have no choice but to overfish so that at least I'll get as much as I possibly can before the resource collapses. And so what we end up with is situations where when there's not one group in control of the resource, it almost always ends up collapsing because we can't trust each other. And those two rules would have held in a big way for our ancestors. And so the main advantage that we have in that regard is that it was rarely the case that our ancestors could overexploit resources. Now, the one exception to that is every time human beings moved into a new continent or a new island, if there was a resource that was large and really valuable, and especially one that wasn't used to humans, we quickly overexploited it and caused it to go extinct. And you can see that over and over again as we moved into these new environments as human beings left Africa and expanded across the globe, with the most recent example being, you know, human beings arrived in New Zealand shores only 700 years ago. And at that time, there was this very large flightless bird, this moa bird, that was very easy to kill because it wasn't scared of us. Lots of great protein. And we quickly caused those to go extinct. So we had no sense in the past of our enormous capacity to destroy the local, fauna. And so we had no real sense that we ought to be conserving it. It's only now, after having seen enormous devastation that we could cause, that it's become really obvious to us, boy, if we don't want this to happen over and over again, we have to be much better about it. And I think that's a big part of the reason that hunters lead a lot of these conservation movements, because they see the costs of, you know, the prior hunting of bison and all sorts of things, and how they don't want that sort of thing to happen again.
There's nothing like snook hook sets at dawn or catching a tarpon in the moonlight. Find your next fishing trip made easy on fishingbooker.com and experience the magic of the Sunshine State or any other destination on your fishing bucket list. Book a blue water adventure in search of sailfish or go snapper fishing with the kids. With over 6,000 captains and trips to choose from, planning your next one just got a whole lot easier. Download the Fishing Booker app on the Google Play or App Store, or visit them online at fishingbooker.com to book your trip today. You ever get that feeling you're stuck inside staring at screens and a primal urge kicks in? You crave wide open spaces, fresh air, the chance to connect with the land. Well, maybe it's time to find your own piece of the wild, but searching for property can be a maze. That's where land.com comes in. They got millions of listings across the country, from mountain ranches to hidden fishing holes. Their search tools are like a seasoned guide helping you narrow down what you want. Land.com isn't just about buying and selling. It's about finding a place to hunt, fish, explore, or simply sit by a campfire and listen to the crickets. So head over to land.com today to turn one day into today. Because trust me, there's nothing quite like the feeling of standing on your own piece of earth. Hey, Steve here. I want to talk about something crucial for any outdoor enthusiast, which is battery reliability. I've got Interstate batteries powering my gear. I have Interstate batteries in my camper. I run an Interstate battery in my boats. I use Interstate batteries because the last thing I want is to be left powerless. Interstate batteries isn't just another battery company. They are outrageously dependable. In Alaska, the boat dealer that we use for getting stuff and repairs, he uses Interstate. Whether you're gearing up for hunting season, planning your next RV trip, or getting your boat ready, Interstate has the battery for all your needs. With over 150,000 dealer locations, the power you need is always nearby. Interstate batteries aren't just about power. It's about being prepared for any situation. Don't let a dead battery ruin your adventure. Head over to interstatebatteries.com. Use their store locator and equip yourself with a battery that won't let you down. When you're out in the wild or just on your daily commute, an Interstate battery is your key to a dependable journey.
Yeah, that's a great point. It's good to hear from that perspective, because a lot of things we fall into in our modern, I keep saying modern hunting, in our hunting community right now, is that we have these ideals and we know they're deep rooted, but we're just not sure where they might have started or exactly how to relay them past. You know, we know at the turn of the century in this country that we've had a large push towards conservation, but beyond that, we really don't know. We just know there was a lot of pillaging of resources of all kinds in centuries prior to that.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate part of human nature that we really are evolved to worry much more about tomorrow than to worry about 100 years from now. And it's only when we can really stop and reflect and look over long periods of time to see how things have changed that we gain that capacity to also look for long periods of time forward. And that's really the modern world, because our ancestors had no clear capacity to quantify, well, how many of those animals used to run through this area and how many do now. They just weren't able to do that. And so we often think of our distant ancestors as being very conservation-minded because they cared a lot, but they didn't know how to execute. They were far more likely to, you know, pray to the local gods for a good harvest or a good hunt next year than they were to say, well, we've hunted this area a little bit too much, let's move on, because they knew full well that if they moved on, someone else might move in and just finish the job for them. So there's really little that they could do.
Yeah, and as you know, in this day and age, we do think of that we have some dominion over wildlife. We have this need to manage them, and that colors our relationship with wildlife in a pretty deep way. In the modern sense, but that just wasn't the way back as we evolved as humans. There wasn't that relationship. Was it pure opportunistic, or was there some other ritualistic way that it was expressed?
It was ritualistic. It was tied up in local beliefs, but it was also like an ongoing competition where, you know, it's me against the lion. It's me against the wildebeest. I don't feel like I have any dominion over it and any need to protect it. Rather, I feel entirely the opposite, that I'm in competition with it. And one of the things that anthropologists will tell you when they go out and work with these small-scale societies is that the people who live in them can be incredibly cruel to the animals that that they're interacting with. They don't have the same sense of responsibility over them. And so the anthropologists can often get sucked into these games where the locals will say, well, if you don't give me X, I'm going to torture this animal to death. And I know it sounds horrible, but for them, it's not a torturing the animal to death doesn't have any moral implications. And they just see that the anthropologist is so squeamish about it that they start to take advantage of that. Now, of course, slowly over time, that changes as people start to realize population density goes up and they do have dominion over these things. But it takes a long time to get there. It's a very modern concept.
Yeah. And can you give some when we talk about these comparisons, I mean, we are traveling, like I said earlier, over millions of years here. Can you give some, and I've seen this expressed a few places, but do you have anything in your, you know, in your vocabulary or in the ways you like to use analogies to this, of how much time we were hunter-gatherers to the amount of time that we have not been hunter-gatherers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So basically, when I think about the origin of a species, it's very close to us. Homo erectus is really that one. Prior to that, we're really much more chimp than we are human. And after that, we're really much more human than we are chimp. And so that's about 1.7 to 1.9 million years ago. So from that time forward, we're slowly becoming us. And we have, and so we've got a little over 1.5 million years. And for almost that entire history, all we are every day is hunter-gatherers, immediate return hunter-gatherers. Killing today and then eating today. And if we don't kill today, we don't eat. We only eat what somebody dug up, which is an inferior food. And so you've got almost 2 million years of that history. And then agriculture was invented about 12,000 years ago. And not everywhere. In some spots, they're really suitable for agriculture. And so people got, you know, the Middle East and China, for example. And other spots were less suitable for agriculture. And so, in fact, in some places, agriculture was never invented. It was never used. So basically, you've got the sort of last couple versions of our species for almost 2 million years, and for a little less than 10,000 of that, we've been growing food on our own. Now, that's not to say that we haven't been gathering that whole time, because, of course, human beings are omnivorous, and so it's one of the very standard divisions of labor by sex is females tended to go gather, and males tended to hunt large animals. So we've been eating lots of plant life for a very long time. But we've been always going back and forth between eating the plants we could gather and the animals that we could hunt. And it's only just this last blink of time, this last 10,000 years, which, you know, is just a very small window compared to the 2 million years prior, where we've been relying much more heavily on the things that we can grow and moving away from the things that we can hunt. And even then, in the last 10,000 years, lots of societies shifted to agriculture, but lots didn't. You can look at the history of Europe and you can see that hunter-gatherers were coexisting with farmers, you know, for most of that time. It wasn't until very recently that basically hunter-gathering has disappeared from the planet. And that's the last few hundred years. Prior to that, hunter-gathering was still existing all over the planet.
Yeah. We had a podcast earlier in this summer and discussing the Lamellarans, which are a subsistence whaling tribe off an island off the coast of Indonesia. And in that discussion, we talked about the not eradication, it's probably not the right word, but the elimination of some of these hunter-gatherer cultures, these subsistence cultures. And over time, the percentage, we have cut off 40% of the different types of cultures. There went from thousands and thousands of cultures to relatively few based on the comparative number. Have you studied and looked at that over the time?
Yeah, the downside is that if you look at the history of agriculture, first of all, as we just discussed, it's only 1% of our sort of history is kind of human-like animals. So 99% of our human-like history is hunter-gathering, 1% is agriculture. And now you take that 1% of the time, and what you realize is that actually it's a really bad deal for any of the individual farmers once we switched over. So they went from this diet that admittedly wasn't very balanced on any one day, because it's whatever you killed, you ate, but was very balanced over time. And so they've got this really balanced diet. They've got this really active lifestyle where they are out for a few hours each day hunting, and then they've got leisure to spend time with each other. But they're always moving around. They're nomadic. And now you become sedentary, and you become heavily reliant on the starchy diet. And so for the individual farmers, it was a terrible deal. They worked harder to get less. They were shorter than their ancestors. They were less healthy than their ancestors because they introduced all sorts of diseases from the animals that they're now living cheek by jowl with, all sorts of problems like that. But the carrying capacity of the land is so much greater for agriculture than it is for hunter-gathering. And so slowly over time, you've got agriculturalists are displacing hunter-gatherers everywhere, even though the agriculturalists themselves, until very recently, were less healthy specimens. There's simply more of them. And so over time, if you look at we can now do this lovely genetics to look at human movements over the last several thousand years, and you can just see all sorts of incursions by hunter-gatherer populations, but then they always get assimilated. They get brought into the agricultural populations because there's simply more of them. It's impossible to win that fight, so to speak. And so a bazillion cultures get slowly whittled away until there's only a few left. Now, admittedly, all of our genes are still in the gene pool. You know, it's rare that people get wiped out entirely. It's much more common that they get assimilated. But so genetically, we're all still there. But linguistically and in different cultural habits, they're gone.
Yeah. Now, do you feel that technology is kind of a similar or the same force to agriculture? Like it will have the same effect?
Yeah, it will. Because if you think about technology, you know, it makes everything super duper easy, although it makes all of us stuck at our computers all day long. And so we, again, become less healthy. Our posture's worse, all sorts of things. You know, we didn't evolve to sit on our rear ends all day. Your telomeres actually get longer the longer you sit. The longer you sit, and that's a sign that you're shortening your life. So it's not good for any individual, but of course it's super effective for society. Ideas pass instantaneously. There's this sort of cultural soup that shifts quickly, but everyone gets assimilated to it. And so you can easily imagine a world. If you and I were having this conversation 200 years from now, I have to believe there's going to be very few languages that are left on Earth. There's just going to be a few dominant languages that everybody speaks. Hmm. Everybody will know all the same stuff because it'll be instantly accessible on the internet. I mean, it'll be great in some ways because we still have lots of disease and lots of starvation and all that, and that'll be eliminated. But there'll be a cost to that, right? There'll be lots of interesting human differences will be lost.
Yeah. Now, that's something that just strikes me now that as we're going through this conversation, that there are these forces that you know, we stumble upon or we create, however we get there as humans, however we evolve to these abilities, that while they are advantageous in the moment and maybe, as you say, advantageous for our overall society, they start to eat away at some of the core of these aspects of humanity that we're talking about, which is movement, which is hunting, which is that. And I wonder how, you know, if I would just say personally as a hunter, I feel this calmness when I'm hunting. I feel this urge to go there. And when I don't, it's like medicine. If I don't have that medicine, I feel certain things. I feel depressed when I'm sitting in traffic, or maybe depressed when I'm eating some sort of fast food, and hunting is this kind of weird medicine. And again, much like we were talking about earlier, it's hard to articulate what that really means.
It is super interesting, and there's more and more data now that show that when you get out in nature, it's actually good for your mental health. It's good for your brain functioning. It's an early area of this research. We don't know exactly why, but I think that, of course, it comes back to the fact that when we're out hunting, when we're in charge, so to speak, when we're out seeking game, when we're out exploring nature, we are in an element that's very natural for us and that we understand intuitively. And so it doesn't, you know, if I'm walking through a city, there's all sorts of potential threats and opportunities, but none of them are naturally connected to my psychology. I have to literally figure them out. Oh, do I want that pizza? Oh, should I avoid that car? Whereas when you're in the woods, you know that your mind is attuned to what's going on around you. And you know that if there's danger, your attention will be automatically drawn to it. And so you can kind of rely on the way your brain has worked for, you know, many millennia, hundreds of thousands of years. You can rely on the fact that that's going to guide you well. Whereas in a city, you need this constant alertness and attention. And of course, sitting in traffic is ghastly because you need it all and nothing's happening. And so it is the case that the psychology is showing that being out in nature is super important to us. Now, will it always be? I don't know. But it certainly is now, given this long evolutionary history we evolved in of being in nature and being successful out there.
Yeah, I mean, is there ever a time where you imagine that these things aren't kind of underpinnings of who we are, that we have kind of technology and agriculture and processing of foods and the availability of shelter and just the way that we live kind of erases completely these urges? Or do you feel like just based on millions of years, they'll always be there?
Well, always is a very long word, right? So yeah. It's super hard to know what our species is like in 100,000 years or 200,000 years. But, you know, our species is about 250-ish thousand years old. It's a blend. There's no defining line where if you and I walk back through time, we go, okay, that guy's Homo erectus and that guy's Homo sapiens. So there's not a cut point. But nonetheless, if you look at this continuous evolution over the last few million years, it's always been in nature. And so, in my mind, it would take a few million years to erase it, but I don't see our progeny as being desirous of erasing it, especially if these current population models are accurate in that we tend to live in cities, we tend to live, our families get smaller, their world population decreases. There's always going to be lots of nature out there. You know, you can sort of feel like it's under threat when you look at the last 100 years, but I suspect that if you look at the next 100 years, we're going to do a much better job with a decrease in population and a greater sensitivity to the problem. And so my guess is it'll always be important to us, and it'll always be something that human beings seek. And just walking in the woods, and I was just in Alaska last time we chatted, and you know, we're walking along, my brothers and I, and up comes this bull moose on the trail ahead of us. And so, you know, it's this exciting moment where you're negotiating with a relatively large animal. You both want to go your separate ways, and you're not quite sure how it's going to end up. And that's how we evolved, doing those kinds of things all the time. We didn't evolve to be trying to get at a crosswalk and wait to cross the street when all the traffic settles down and the kinds of things that we spend most of our lives doing now.
Yeah, and I feel like there is that. And the people ask me, or we get in these conversations of what is the future of hunting and how will it change? How will the demographics of hunting change? How can it shift and kind of generationally remain relevant? And I often say that I see in people that live in predominantly urban settings and suburban settings, I see in them the urge to go and explore these things, the urge to get outside, the urge to escape. I don't want to call it a concrete prison, but to escape that urban environment, thing that isn't so natural to them. So I've seen, even though urbanization in the short term here in this last 30 years span has kind of killed hunting in a way, or at least stopped its growth in the modern sense, it might eventually be an outlet for this urge that we're going to increasingly feel as technology and kind of urban landscapes just continue to grow.
Yeah, I think so. And so with the question that's interesting to me, and I don't know the answer, is will this be something where people slowly shift away from hunting and they become campers, for example, where they go out into it but they don't hunt in it? Or will it be something where we're always hunting? If I had to bet, I would say that hunting is not going to disappear because it played so much of an important role in our ancestry that it is in our DNA, like throwing rocks is. And so there's always going to be people who are keen to go out and hunt. And enough of them that the laws are unlikely to be changed to make it so that it's something you just can't do. And especially since there'd be a certain degree of hypocrisy to saying, well, you can't go hunt a deer, but I can kill this cow and eat it, right? So, you know, as long as we're doing one, we're going to be doing the other. Now, you've probably seen this work where they're growing meat in petri dishes.
Yeah.
And eventually we may get so good at that that then nobody's animal farming anymore. And if nobody's animal farming, you could imagine a world where people who are against it start changing the laws and so you can't hunt. But I'm not even sure about that. I don't know that, you know, especially since the responsible hunting doesn't, there's no threat of extinction. It can keep the balance between different animals together. It's not clear to me that that would ever disappear.
Yeah, and I think as long as we're articulating the benefits and society understands those things, then, yeah, I can agree with that. I think being in the community and seeing it shrink and understanding, like, just from my father's generation to mine, there's been such this, you know, tectonic shift in who is doing it and how many folks are doing it and how accepted it is or not. I think those of us in now that are hunters are get a little bit worried. It's like, if it continues this way for very long, then this thing will be over. But it's nice to hear you say that, I guess. It feels good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not very good at predicting the future. I'm much better at looking at the past, but it seems to me that hunters are also very sensitive to where it's going. And so if you look at some of the strongest conservationists in today's world are hunters because they're very concerned about the future of it. And that's the kind of thing, of course, that keeps it going.
Yeah, it's these kind of conversations that really understand where we've been, to understand where we're going. You know, it seems sometimes, you know, a little bit silly to speak in like, oh, that 2 million years, 3 million years, 4 million years, and in those terms, yeah. But it is because that's just not how our minds work. That we can't conceive of that, I wouldn't think.
It's not. There are numbers that are so ridiculous, you can't really imagine them, and so we can say them, but to feel what it's like is absurd. I mean, in just a few generations, no one will ever know that I even existed, much less in a million years, when none of us will ever know anyone existed. You know, it's just the world changes so dramatically.
Well, that's the task you've taken on in human evolutionary biology. Yeah. I don't know what you do is to understand the scope of our humanity and give us a little bit of information in our very brief pinprick time of existence here to kind of do it a little bit better. And that's what I hoped out of this conversation. And I've just, like I said earlier, become interested in this just because, one, because you were on with my friend Joe Rogan, but less that. It's more just, as you talk about, you know, the relevancy of the things we feel and the things we're grappling with right now as hunters, it's very relevant to our history, and it is colored and painted by our past and is many millions of years that are there to explore. So, I mean, it just seems endless, an endless subject to discuss.
It is. Yeah, it is. It's super interesting, and I wish I were more expert in the more modern side of it, but because there's lots of very interesting questions of how it all changed just in the last 1,000 years, just in the last 100 years. And those questions I'm less aware of. I don't know as much of that anthropological work, but it's all tightly tied to the same basic questions, which is, you know, how did our species evolve and what role did hunting play in it? And then how can we use that knowledge going forward to do it better?
Yeah, that's perfect. And we always say you're not going to continue doing things because they were done in the past. There's a lot of horrors in our past that we've erased, but we certainly can learn from something that is part of who we are and continue to push forward and preserve the things that are, you know, that need to be preserved.
Absolutely. We can, yeah. To use history to benefit tomorrow is the exact reason why we remember in the first place. There's zero point in remembering our past if we can't use it to make a better future.
Beautiful. Well, that's a great place to end. Dr. Von Hippel, thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation. I want to do it again because I think we could probably start from a million years ago and continue to work. But until that time, everyone go out and pick up The Social Leap. Like I said, we often on this podcast talk about hunting books and books about turkey hunting and how to talk to a turkey. This is not that, but it is a primer to everything you think about when you're out hunting. And it's fascinating and a wonderful read.
Well, thanks, Ben. I really enjoyed chatting with you. It's a super interesting topic, and I do hope we get a chance to talk again, hopefully in person next time.
Yeah, yeah. For those who don't, you would know the backstory. I tried to fly to Alaska, couldn't make it. We tried to set this up over phone a couple of times, and Bill has been very patient with me and very kind to spend the time.
Totally my pleasure.
All right. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
That's it. That's all. Another episode in the books. Thank you so much to William Von Hippel. I apologize for saying William Von Nipple. But, you know, maybe it'll stick and maybe it'll somehow
enhance your public persona. But I need to apologize. William was very cool and very helpful with us. We actually, Phil's first day here. He probably doesn't like that I'm saying this now, but one of his first days here, we set up a phone call podcast with William Von Hippel and then couldn't make it work. So he sat there for like 25 minutes while we jangled around with phones and things. And then prior to that, I was supposed to go meet him in Anchorage, and I did not get that done. So he was very, very gracious in his time. So thank you for that, William, and thanks for the great conversation. I hope we can do more of that because it is absolutely critical to the way we think about hunting. And thanks to our team, including Sam Soholt, who drove the bus over here after the Total Archery Challenge to get silly with us about top fives. I will say that Meatloaf song may become the new THC theme song. It might. I don't know. Old Number 7 is great, but a lot of you guys write in and label that as a hipster song, which I don't agree with. You think that's a hipster song, Phil? Old Number 7? He doesn't think so. He says no. And so that's that for this episode. The last three episodes I really enjoyed. We're going to continue that next week. We had Keith Balford from Boone and Crockett in the studio to talk about the history of the Boone and Crockett Club and get into some of their Fair Chase statement, public statements, and some of their Hunt Right campaign, and went deep on Fair Chase and what it means for us. Hopefully you're still willing to have that conversation with us, because we're going to keep chugging on it as long as we can. What else? THC at themeateater.com, THC at themeateater.com. I will admit to having so many emails from these last two vegan animal rights episodes. A lot of you guys were fired up. You were thinking hard. You were writing me very long emails. Many of you, very long emails. And I did my very best to read every single one of them. In fact, for the first time ever, THC at themeateater.com was getting three times the emails that my actual work email was getting. So I don't know what that means, but I enjoy all the messages. So please keep them coming, thc@themeateater.com. Please keep sending me your audio clips and reviews of the show. Take out your phone, hit the notes, hit record, and then email it to me, thc@themeateater.com. We love to hear them, love the feedback. That's what we do. So with that, we'll leave you with some Old Number 7, and we'll see you next week. Bye. Thank you, Jack Daniels, Old Number 7. Tennessee whiskey got me drinking in heaven, and angels start to look good to me. They're gonna have to deport me to the fiery deeps. Oh, to the fiery deeps. Drinking in heaven. To the fiery deeps. Oh, to the fiery deeps. Drinking in heaven.
You ever get that feeling, the walls closing in, the concrete jungle suffocating you? You crave some wide open spaces, the chance to connect with nature, maybe in a spot all your own. Well, head over to land.com. They've got ranches, forests, mountains, streams, you name it. Search by acreage. You can search by location. You can search by the kind of hunting and fishing you're dreaming of. Land.com. It is where the adventure begins. Hey, we're going to take a little break here and talk about Interstate batteries. Now, if you're like me, enjoying the great outdoors, you need gear that is as reliable as it gets. That's why I power my adventures with Interstate batteries. I use Interstate batteries in my boats. I use Interstate batteries in my camper. Great for your truck, too. From Alaska to Montana, they're outrageously dependable. Battery is essential. With over 150,000 dealer locations, finding one is easy. For all your vehicles, land or sea, choose Interstate. Head to interstatebatteries.com and find your power today.